Welcome behind the news for December 19, 2002. This is Doug Henwood, and we're looking, as we do most weeks at this time, at the worlds of economics and politics. And I've got two segments up for tonight, and once again, I'm doing the Brian Lamb thing and interviewing authors. First, we'll speak with Mark Kurtzgaard, who is the author of The Eagle's Shadow, Why America Fascinates and Infuriates the World. And then at the bottom of the hour, an interview with Thomas Berkey, who is a professor at Wellesley College, a visiting scholar at University of California, Berkeley, and author of a book on lawyers and litigation and why we have so many lawsuits in America. Or do we really have so many lawsuits? And if we do, is it a bad thing or a good thing or a bit of both? Thomas Berkey will answer those questions at about starting at about 5:30. And let's get right into the first segment. Mark Kurtzgaard is an author of quite a few books, perhaps most known for On Bended Knee, a book about the press during the Reagan years, also a book, the book Earth Odyssey, and now The Eagle's Shadow, Why America Fascinates and Infuriates the World. And it's rare that a book gets a review that almost could serve as a case study of its premise, but Michiko Kakutani in her New York Times Daily Book Review on November 15 ran a rather stupid, extravagantly stupid review that described Mark Kurtzgaard as having written a hectoring, fuzzy-minded book that dissolves into an angry personal rant. My God, he actually suggests that the United States is hypocritical in its backing of treacherous dictatorships that serve our perceived interests. What an outrageous assertion, and really much too much for daily reviewer for the New York Times, Michiko Kakutani, who is a product of one of our fine universities, Yale. And now we have on the line Mark Kurtzgaard, joining us from San Francisco. Welcome to WBAI, Mark.
Thanks very much for having me. You're making me chuckle here.
Well, that was the idea. That was an extraordinarily stupid review.
But it got under her skin a bit, didn't it?
I was going to say, that's one of those bad reviews that can almost make you feel proud because you did something right if you annoyed Michiko Kakutani.
It was surprising. I mean, I don't think of myself as someone who writes rants, and if anything, I thought that review was quite a rant. But, you know, not all the news is fit to print, I guess.
No, certainly not. And criticisms of the American way of life are not in order these days. Well, you've got two themes in the book that you go back and forth between, why America fascinates and infuriates the world. I suspect this is one of the rare audiences you're going to be talking to that doesn't have much of a problem with the infuriating part. The fascinating part may be more of a challenge for a Pacifica audience. But who is the book addressed to exactly?
Well, it's interesting. You know, you mentioned Kakutani's review. It's so different, the reaction that I've gotten to this book here in the United States compared to overseas. And the book is addressed both to U.S. readers and non-U.S. readers. In fact, quite honestly, Doug, the book began mainly intended for my foreign publishers. This was a book that was begun long before September 11th, and the idea behind it was to try and explain America to foreigners, because they're always interested in it. When I was traveling around the world for my previous book, Earth Odyssey, everyone was always fascinated to talk about America when they learned that's where I was from. And so that was my idea for this new book, was to try and explain America to foreigners. And then, you know, I thought that maybe it would be published here in the United States, but probably by a small university press or not a commercial house. And, you know, I wonder, had September 11th not happened, I'm not sure that it would have been published as it was here in the United States. So when you ask who's the book addressed to, it's addressed to two very different audiences, and that was the great challenge in the book, was to try and write an essay that would be meaningful for both parties.
Of course, the book is published by Farrar Straus, which is a very distinguished publisher, of course, but also, I believe, owned by a German firm, so it requires a little foreign influence to get this kind of thing published here.
Well, I don't think so. I think, you know, Farrar Straus, and in particular Jonathan Galassi, my editor there, deserve real commendations for showing the courage to publish a book like this a year after September 11th. You know, I told Jonathan that these were the kind of reviews that we were probably going to get, and he nevertheless went ahead with it. So I think it's important to recognize that.
Yeah, I want to ask at the end of this, return to just see what kind of reception you've gotten as you've traveled around talking about the book. But before I do that, just some idea of what your twin themes are, or your multiple themes are.
Sure.
You open with an anecdote about visiting a former coal miner in China who is fascinated by the United States. Could you tell us a bit about Mr. Ma?
Sure. Mr. Ma gave up coal mining in the late 90s after he saw a coworker's head smashed by a runaway coal train, went up above ground, opened up a restaurant, became a budding capitalist, and when he met me, he was thrilled to meet an American because he said, "You in America have had the market economy for a long time. We need to learn its secrets. I want to be rich like you." And I chose that story partly because it was so representative of what I heard from so many people during my travels around the world for this book. I was in 15 countries over the course of 6 months, both before and after September 11th. And, you know, the fact that America is rich is usually the very first thing that comes to foreigners' minds when they think about the United States.
And that wealth, I mean, it must excite a combination of well, the good and bad sides of envy. You know, they want to be like us, but then they hate us for it. What are the varied kinds of responses you got on the question of our wealth and how people feel about it?
You know, it's funny. I did not find that kind of resentment, and I have to confess I sort of expected to find that. Sure, people are envious, but they're envious in the sense that they would like to have it for themselves. Very, very rarely did you hear resentment against Americans simply because they're rich. And I've traveled in very, very poor places around the world, including in starvation zones in Africa. And you don't get the sense that people are angry at Americans because we're rich. What they do get angry about is what we do with our money, and in particular, the way that America has dragged its feet on environmental reform. That was very surprising to me, and I consider myself an environmental reporter. My last book was about the environment. I cover this beat. Nevertheless, when I was in Europe in mid-2001, I was astonished the way that Bush's rejection of the Kyoto Accord on global warming was hugely, hugely controversial there. And even Tony, who has to be Bush's best friend overseas, even Blair was criticizing Bush for that. The media, it was not just a two-day story like it was here in the United States. It went on and on and on. And the public, you know, I would get it in my interviews, which is people on the street. Why is it that you Americans, you're so rich and you use so much of the Earth's resources, why aren't you stepping up to the plate on Kyoto?
Well, what about in poorer countries, too? Do people in poorer countries see the United States as a blood-sucking imperialist that's responsible for their poverty, or do they see any connection between our wealth and their poverty, or is it just not cross their minds?
It really depends. You know, a guy like Mr. Ma, you mentioned, has absolutely no conception of that connection, and it is largely a function of education. And unfortunately, a lot of people who live out in the rural areas in poor countries have little or no education. And for those people, rarely do they make much of a connection between their material deprivation and the United States' enormous material excess. Now, there are exceptions to that if people are politically active or if they have become members of groups, you know, for example, like the groups that do preach hate towards America in some of the fundamentalist Islamic areas, there'll be a connection drawn, not a terribly sophisticated one, but there will be a connection drawn. But, you know, for the most part, and I know a lot of anti-globalization people probably don't want to hear this, but most of the people out there in poor countries, especially young people, are eager for American products and the American lifestyle to come flooding into their countries.
Well, I remember I had a moment myself. I was in Essen, Germany in February of 2000, and Essen is very grim city. It was about 90% bombed out during World War II, rebuilt in a very ugly way. It was February. It was cold. It was rainy. It was just gloomy as hell, really. And I was sitting in a McDonald's, of all places, and there was a teenage girl, she must have been 14 or 15, with a backpack on which she had scrawled with a magic marker about 10 logos of American companies, Nike and things like that. And she had done it with her own hand, who I presume, because it was handwritten on her backpack. And I was thinking to myself, what do these logos mean to her in Essen, Germany? You know, a lot of American leftists think Germany, much more civilized place. Why would they want to be like us? What do you think that those logos mean to a German teenager?
Well, it depends. If she's from a city like Essen, where the unemployment rate is very high and they've been deindustrialized, you know, it's probably seen as a way out, as a symbol of a better life, as hard as that may be for some people to believe. That McDonald's and MT and Britney Spears and all of that, those are to them symbols of cool. And, for example, in Sweden, if you drive west, from Stockholm to the Norwegian border, you are driving through the old coal mining region of Sweden, the historic heart of the Communist Party in Sweden, which is actually quite, historically, has been quite influential. Now, in the last 10 years, McDonald's has moved in there because it's the unemployment rate is so high, you now find a McDonald's about every 40 kilometers. And what's really astonishing about it is that the local municipal governments are giving that land to McDonald's for free to get McDonald's to come in and put some kind of a what they see as a pizzazz and some kind of a social setting. And what's happening is that the young kids and the older people are now flocking to these McDonald's, and they become the equivalent of a community center with those low-wage jobs. That is, in a sense, the talk about gloomy. That's a very gloomy side of globalization, which, by the way, is mainly Americanism.
Speaking with Mark Hertzgard, author of The Eagle's Shadow, Why America Fascinates and Infuriates the World, just published by Farrar Straus. McDonald's, of course, you know, José Bové is famous for having pulled the roof off one in France. And certainly a target of a lot of anti-globalization protests. It's been burned down in the Middle East, in India. Now you're telling me quite the opposite, that McDonald's is kind of craved as a symbol. I mean, what's going on there? I mean, why are there not many José Bové's out there, really?
I see both sides of it, actually. As you know, McDonald's is in very big trouble right now. In fact, I'm just in the middle of reporting a big piece for the New York Times Magazine about the future of McDonald's. They are in big trouble. They are just, I believe, 2 days ago announced that they're going to post their first quarterly loss in the history, in the company's entire 47-year history. And that is partly because of domestic market difficulties, but it is also overseas. They have got big, big problems. Most people, yes, do tend to see McDonald's in a positive light, but there are enough radicals and other critics that McDonald's is facing real difficulties on the ground. Just 10 days ago in Indonesia, a McDonald's was bombed. 3 people were killed. There have been at least half a dozen of these bombings in the past 3 years, most of them, according to authorities, the work of Islamic extremists who see McDonald's as an easier target to hit than the U.S. embassy and yet still a symbol of American domination. So that's a real difficult line for McDonald's to be walking right now. I don't think I would want to be the CEO of that company.
No, they've got a lot of problems in their hands. but you also mentioned an interview with 3 retired terrorists in Cairo, I believe it was.
Yeah.
The concept of retired terrorists is an amusing one. But
that was a new one for me.
Tell us about your chat with the superannuated troublemakers.
Yeah, this was in the Islamic Quarter, which is about the most ancient part of Cairo, holds the oldest mosque and the oldest university in all of Egypt. And I was there with an interpreter and walking around to just try and get the pulse of general people. We walked into a tea shop, and here were these 3 old guys in ankle-length gowns, the normal wear for gentlemen there, sipping tea and smoking water pipes of tobacco and playing cards. And I must say, of the, I don't know, scads, scores, hundreds, whatever, interviews I did for this book, this was the single most hostile one I did. These guys, as I asked questions, were genuinely, they really did not want to have anything to do with me when they learned I was an American. America, in their minds, was simply a corrupter of Egypt's Arabic soul. It was the only reason that the Zionist state of Israel was in power, and so forth. But, interestingly, where their frostiness finally melted a little bit was when I said, well, is there nothing that you like about the United States? How about the movies? And bing, it was like a light went off in their head, and they said, ah, yes, the movies, Kirk Douglas, Kirk Douglas. We liked him very much.
The contradictions are everywhere.
Yes.
I had Hamid Dabashi, a Columbia University scholar of Iranian origin, on the show a few months ago, and he said that the students in Iran love Titanic. That was sort of the countercultural icon of the student protest movement in Iran.
You do see that everywhere. This the contradictions are really quite amazing. You go to Japan, for example. I can't think of a country that is more pro-American than Japan. They consciously say, let's us be number two. America's number one. If we're number two, that's great. And, I mean, here's a country that was bombed at the end of World War II, the only country to ever be bombed with atomic weapons. And talk to young people there now about that, and they just say, ah, ancient history. Talk to the older people, they're not angry about it either. They say, we wanted the war to end. We think that things have worked out pretty well. What's interesting, though, when you talk to them about why they copy America, I interviewed a business executive there. He said, well, it's not just that we copy America, you know. Japanese copy all other cultures. We're an island nation. We copy other cultures. But the difference is that America is so much easier to copy. He says, French food, Italian art, these are not so simple to copy. American fast food, very simple to copy.
Well, Boeing airplanes are a little more difficult to copy.
Yeah.
But you also talked to another fellow in Cairo who wasn't a retired terrorist, who wasn't anywhere near as hostile. What do you have to tell you?
Yes, Mr. Ghali, he's somebody I think, if there's one person that I could bring American people into touch with overseas, he might be the one. He's a guy who, also there in the Islamic Quarter, he was a retired salesman, and about 50 years old. He'd lost a leg in a car accident, so he couldn't work anymore. And we were talking, and I asked him the same question I asked everyone. First question, what's the first thing that comes to your mind when I say America? And he answered back instantly to my interpreter, freedom and democracy. I said, really? Pretty much everyone else here has said Israel. He said, well, yes, I agree with him on that. The American government is bad outside of America and good inside. We don't like the way that you favor Israel. But, and this was what was amazing, he said, but we know that many of you Americans also disagree with your government about this because you have free, you have good minds and you are allowed to think for yourselves. Now, what's interesting to me about that is that here's a guy who does not have democracy, does not have freedom. He lives in a country, Egypt, that has barely formal democracy and is where the government is kept in power primarily through American support. Our military and economic support is what keeps the Mubarak government in power in Egypt. Nevertheless, this guy looks to America as the symbol of freedom and democracy around the world. And to me, I found that so interesting and inspiring, and it shows the responsibility that Americans have to clean up our own democracy. In the countries where I have been that have the least freedom, China, Russia, Egypt, and others, that's where I've heard repeatedly, America, freedom, democracy, they look to us as an example. And we need to live up to that example a whole lot better than we do right now.
A lot of your book is also devoted to explaining American, or exploring American naivete about the outside world and the reasons for it. Certainly our democracy in your portrait and many others doesn't look so rich as our, some of our fans abroad would like it to be.
That's true.
You quote that fellow from the Financial Times story who said, you know, Americans live in this world of almost childlike innocence or ignorance. Just how isolated are we from opinions and of people outside our borders and knowledge of life outside our borders?
Well, we're extraordinarily isolated, and it's one thing that, that foreigners find both amusing and exasperating about us, that here we are, a country that we don't know any other foreign languages, we know little about foreign culture, we don't even know where countries are. I don't know if you saw National Geographic 2 weeks ago released a survey of 18 to 24-year-olds in America. Only one out of seven could even find Iraq on a map. Some of those people are going to be going there to fight pretty soon. They can't even find it on a map. And yet, despite all that, we assume that we know best for everyone else, that what we say is what other people should do. And if there's one thing that I would like this book to, in a small way, help accomplish, is to wake us up to the importance of taking the rest of the world seriously. Instead of treating them like subjects that we command, let's treat them like neighbors that we respect. And if we do that, we will find, I think, that we will be embraced by the rest of the world. The rest of the world does not hate us, the American people. They like us, thank God, because we absolutely need the help of the rest of the world in the years to come, not just to deal with the Al-Qaeda threat, but to deal with immigration, to deal with environmental degradation, all of the problems that loom out before us. We cannot solve them in a unilateral way, and that's why we have to get to know our neighbors a lot better than we do now.
You did a book about 15 years ago on the press during the Reagan years, and there's a chapter on the American media in this book as well. How have things gotten in the last 15 years? Are their knees even more deeply bended than they were during the Reagan days?
I'm afraid so. I'm sorry to say that, speaking as a journalist, that my profession has sunken so low. And part of the reason that I put that chapter in the new book is to explain to foreigners why American foreign policy is the way it is. Many, many times, I don't know if this was your experience overseas, but foreigners will say to me, why don't you Americans care that your government is, you name it, imposing economic sanctions in Iraq that are killing hundreds of thousands of kids? Why don't you care that your government was backing death squads in El Salvador, or you name it? And I say, look, it's not that Americans don't care, it's that they don't know. Americans do not know our own foreign policy, and that's largely because the media does such a poor job of reporting it. The media in general, for profit reasons, have done less and less international news, and then for ideological reasons, when they do international news, it tends to come from the perspective of the powers that be in Washington. It's not that they deliberately suppress news or that they consciously try and promote any president's agenda. It's rather that their definition of responsible news is the news as described and articulated by the Democratic and Republican parties in Washington. And if those Democrats and Republicans are not talking about a certain issue, you will not see it in the press. Very good example, this week Bush has said we're going to install missile defenses. Now, anybody who knows anything about that issue knows that it does not work, has not worked. It's been a multi-billion-dollar boondoggle for years. But none of the Democrats nor the Republicans will say that for other reasons, largely ideological, but also because of the money that goes into the military industry through this corporate welfare program. And because of that, this basic fact about Star Wars is left out of the news, that it cannot work. That's a good example of why Americans are so ignorant about our foreign policy and how our foreign policy is perceived overseas.
Well, I've always wondered, though, if some of that ignorance is a kind of unconscious repressive mechanism. They sort of know, but they really don't want to think about it because it's too ugly. So they just sort of close their eyes to it. Do you think there's anything to that?
I think there's some truth to that, and I don't want to let people off the hook too easily. I did a piece in the Guardian newspaper in Britain on September 11th that talked about this point, and I got a lot of emails back saying, wait, you're letting the American public off too easily. And it's true, in today's technological society, you're just one mouse click away on the Internet from reading The Guardian or the BBC, which I think is the best news organization in the world right now. There are alternative sources of information, and if Americans are going to, if we want the benefits of living in a democracy, we have to fulfill the responsibilities of a citizen. And one of those basic responsibilities is to inform yourself. And it's not that hard right now through the Internet. You can go, as I am right now, online to the Left Business Observer, or you can go to the BBC, as I say, or the Times of India, or any number of other news organizations around the world that will give you a different, more rounded perspective than simply relying on the corporate media here in the United States.
And what about the post-September 11th world? Has that made Americans even more insular and arrogant, or has it made us more humble and interested in people abroad, or has it done a bit of both? How do you read it?
I think there you have to make the distinction that so many foreigners do, between America and Americans. I think Americans, that is the people of this country, got a good shock on September 11th. It was tragic, it was terrible, but if there's some silver lining, it's that a lot of us said, hey, we've got to learn a little bit more about the rest of the world. We emptied libraries and bookstores of books on this topic. Even our media for a little while there remembered that that news is supposed to be about something. Now, they backtracked, and Americans are sort of on their own to do this. Unfortunately, our government has gotten even more unilateral, more bellicose, less interested in genuine international cooperation. And as a result, amazingly, President Bush has squandered that entire sympathy vote that America got after September 11th. Our global standing was never higher than right after that, all the solidarity that we got from people around the world. And now this Pew survey of 38,000 people around the world that was just released last week, that found that America is even less popular now than it was before September 11th. That is the biggest indictment of the Bush administration I can think of, and if the Democratic Party has any brains, they'll make an issue of it.
Well, that may be hoping for a lot.
Maybe.
Thank you for joining us, Mark Kurtzgaard. Mark Kurtzgaard is the author of The Eagle's Shadow, Why America Fascinates and Infuriates the World, just published by Farrar Straus. And I'm going to be leaving in a moment, but you'll hear the rest of the program on recording. I won't be here next week either, but I will be also here on recording. I'm going to rerun the interview I did with the Nobel Prize winner in economics from last year, Joseph Stiglitz. It's not every day you get to interview a Nobel laureate, so why not relive past glories? And let's take this little break from P.J. Harvey, and then we'll return with an interview with Tom Berkey. And that was P.J. Harvey in an excerpt from her song Big Exit from her album about this city, New York. And this is WBAI 99.5 FM in New York and on the web at WBAI.org. My name is Doug Henwood and the show is Behind the News. And now for our final segment, an interview I recorded earlier this week with Thomas Berkey, author of the book Lawyers, Lawsuits, and Legal Rights, The Battle Over Litigation in American Society, recently published by the University of California Press. Berkey, spelled like Edmund, but pronounced in two syllables, is a professor at Wellesley College and a visiting scholar at Berkeley. We all hear about the litigation explosions. Republicans hate it, and Ralph Nader celebrates it. But is it real? What does it mean? Where does it come from? And what are the alternatives? These are some of the questions that Berkey addresses in this interview. Thomas Berkey.
Welcome to WBA, Thomas Berkey. First of all, before we get to your analysis of the situation, two questions. Is the United States undergoing a litigation explosion after all? And is the United States uniquely litigious in the world?
No and no are the answers. No litigation explosion. just looked at the figures. From 1975 to 2001, 38% increase in civil litigation, but a 32% increase in population. So you can judge for yourself if that's an explosion. Is the U.S. uniquely litigious? Hard to say, but the available evidence doesn't suggest that. It suggests actually that we're kind of in the middle range, surprisingly.
Where does the impression come from that the answers to both those questions have been yes and yes?
Well, the argument I make is that even though we don't have a lot of claims filed, or we don't seem to have so many lawsuits as people seem to think, we do have a lot of policies, I call them litigious policies, that create the threat of litigation. And the threat of litigation has effects even when people don't file lawsuits. And we have very few litigation-free zones. If you think about American society today compared to 50 years ago, the places where people can challenge authority figures by filing lawsuits have expanded tremendously. Just think of what's happening in the Catholic Church recently. So I think there's that. The other side of it is there's a very well-funded corporate campaign to focus attention on one kind of litigation, personal injury litigation, and to claim that lawsuits are out of control, litigation's crazy. And I think that campaign has penetrated the American consciousness.
Well, of course, there's the stories of the woman who sued for having a hot cup of coffee spill on her, sued McDonald's. Are these typical, and should people be outraged when they hear these stories?
They are not typical. The typical thing that happens when people are injured in accidents is they don't sue. And this is something that's pretty obscured. This is a country mostly of people who lump or find compensation in other ways. And I can give you a couple of simple statistics on this. Number one, a study of households found that when people felt that they had been injured by at least $1,000 because of someone's illegal conduct, only 5 out of 1,000 of them ended up filing suits. Only 1 out of 8 people who were seriously injured, medical malpractice, end up filing a lawsuit. So, if you look at all the ways in which people recover for accidents, when people are injured in accidents, about 1/3 of the cost is borne by the people themselves. Most of the rest is borne by disability programs and healthcare programs, insurance, private and public. And only about 6 or 7% comes out of the tort liability system.
I'm almost hesitant now to ask any further questions of the litigation explosion. It doesn't really exist. But you have explanation for this role of litigation in American politics and society that is a little different from what the standard line is. You know, the standard critique is that we're a bunch of whiners or trying to get some free money out of some deep-pocketed corporations. These are all but individual sort of character kinds of explanations. You've got a more system-oriented explanation. What is it exactly?
Yeah, let me back up for just a second and say that narratives, stories, anecdotes are extraordinarily powerful. And anecdotes about tort are uniquely powerful. And, for instance, the McDonald's story, you know, just radiates through public discourse. And I think it taps into certain cultural frames that we all have about in the U.S. about individual responsibility. I think those are very powerful. I can tell people the McDonald's story and add all the facts that were somewhat obscured, like, you know, McDonald's coffee had scalded zillions of people before, and the burns were very bad, and she didn't get nearly as much money as everyone seems to think, and yet most people are still outraged by that verdict. So the stories are powerful. Now, the systematic explanation. Why do we have all these litigious policies, all these possibilities for litigation in the United States? And my argument is that this is about attitudes towards government. In all societies, people want to solve basic social problems. They want to deal with injury. They want to deal with accidents. They want to deal with discrimination, environmental problems. In the U.S., we have a problem, which is that we do not trust government, and we have a very decentralized political system. And so it's very hard to use governmental programs to address these things to the extent that other affluent nations do. So instead, we authorize private lawsuits. It fits our values. It says we're going to let individuals do these things. We're not going to build up government through building up regulatory agencies or building up welfare.
You make some interesting points about even how our judicial structure differs from other rich industrial countries. Could you talk about that a bit?
Yeah, we have a system that's kind of outrageous to a lot of other countries. You know, most countries, judges are kind of civil servants. They're bureaucrats. They go to judging school after law school. They get an undergraduate law degree, then they go to judging school, then they basically rise up through a judging bureaucracy. So they're pretty separated from the political system. Now think about our system in contrast. There's no judging school. People instead become judges largely because they come to the attention of some politician who favors them in some way. Or they run for office, as is very common at the state level. So our system encourages judges to be much more independent, to be tied to politics in ways that judges aren't in other countries.
And also the structures of the courts themselves are quite different.
Well, the structures of the courts are decentralized. We really have 51 different systems. And the Supreme Court, it's a pretty decentralized system. If you think about the Supreme Court, we think of it as sitting at the top of this of all these 51 systems. But the Supreme Court can only review a small number of cases every year. Full review now down to 100. And there are thousands, hundreds of thousands of cases. In fact, I always tell my students, 92 million cases a year, 60 million of them are traffic. But the Supreme Court can only review a tiny fraction of those. So the system is extraordinarily decentralized.
Before I get to the ADA, I want to talk about Ralph Nader. Could you talk about how Ralph Nader fits into this world of litigation?
Ralph Nader is just an exemplary American in so many ways. On one hand, he is someone who sees horrible social problems that need to be dealt with, the environment, consumer, health, all kinds of issues that he's interested in. On the other hand, he's profoundly distrustful of bureaucracies. He even says about his own organizations that he wants to avoid having them become like bureaucracies. And he rails against even the bureaucracies that his own movement created. He thinks that bureaucrats become lazy, indifferent, they don't go out and solve social problems on their own, they become tied to corporate interests. So he wants to create free agents. And he loves the common law. Why? Because you have a bunch of free agents in this system, not tied to any structure. On one hand, juries. People walk into that room, they have no allegiance, they walk out at the end of the day. He loves that. And then you have these private attorneys general, these plaintiff lawyers, who go out and look for injustice. They're kind of lone rangers seeking to find something to rectify. And they make money in the process. That's fine. But the important thing is that they're not constrained. They're individuals out there. And I think that's a very American idea, that the way to solve social problems is to authorize individuals to go out and try to solve them.
And just one more item on Nader. He lost his friends in the Trial Lawyer Association right after running for president.
Well, one of the things that will be interesting to see over the next few years about the politics of litigation is what effects that will have. Nader was a hero to the trial lawyers, to the plaintiff lawyers. And there have always been tensions between the consumer movement and the plaintiff lawyers, but to a large extent they were allies. Then in 2000, Nader did something that just, I think, has permanently separated him from the plaintiff lawyers, which was running against Gore and helping to defeat Gore. And the plaintiff lawyers were very, very angry. They said, you know, he used to be worshipped at our conventions. Now if he showed up, he'd have to find a bodyguard, because they feel that having Democrats in office is the key to maintaining the tort system as it exists.
Yeah, this is a common charge, of course, the Republicans have, that the Democrats' party is sustained by trial lawyers and that they serve the interests of trial lawyers, and then the Republicans are battling inefficiencies by exposing this. What exactly are behind the partisan politics of the fight over litigation and trial lawyers?
The plaintiff tort litigation debate, the debate over tort, personal injury lawsuits, we call those tort lawsuits, tort is a personal injury, is really not unlike the regulatory debate. Republicans line up with business interests, and they want less regulation, less litigation, and Democrats line up with consumer and plaintiff lawyer groups, and they try to maintain the existing tort system. and to some extent expand it. My own feeling about the whole debate over tort litigation is that it's misframed, because the most common solution that Republicans have for problems with the personal injury system is simply to cap damages. And I think that's the worst possible kind of reform, because what it basically does is stops money from going to the most injured victims. It really doesn't do anything about the things that most Republicans claim to be opposing: frivolous lawsuits, lack of coordination among courts, things like that. You need much more substantive reform for that.
I'm speaking with Thomas Berkey, author of Lawyers, Lawsuits, and Legal Rights, recently published by the University of California Press.
Okay, let's talk about a case study, which I think of the ones you write about in the book. I think the Americans with Disabilities Act would probably be the most interesting to the audience. And this is fairly recent history. We can look at how the law was framed, and it promoted a litigious outcome. Could you talk about how the ADA came to be, and why the set of remedies that it embodies are the ones that why it came to be the way it is?
Well, the beginnings of the Americans with Disabilities Act can be traced to an earlier law, Section 504 of the 1973 Rehabilitation Act, which basically said that for entities receiving federal funds, they should not discriminate against people with disabilities. Now, the idea here was really to take the civil rights movement and both the ideas behind the civil rights movement and the remedies that were created during the civil rights movement and apply them to people with disabilities. And so the 1973 Rehabilitation Act was the beginning of this. And then in the 80s, there was, along with all the other deregulatory crusades in the Reagan administration, an attack on Section 504. And during this attack, the disability rights movement got a brilliant idea, which was to say to conservatives, look, you want people with disabilities to work, just like everyone else. You want welfare mothers to work. You want people with disabilities to work. People with disabilities are huge consumers of state services, of welfare. We agree with you. We want to get people with disabilities out into the world and off welfare and into jobs. So we should work together. And this was a pitch that was accepted first by conservatives in the Reagan administration and then by George Bush the Elder, who very much supported the Americans with Disabilities Act. And I think liked the idea that this was welfare to work, and also that it would not create a huge bureaucracy. These, to the extent that were going to be problems with the law, they were going to be resolved through litigation, just like in the Civil Rights Act.
And, of course, a lot of the adaptations, building ramps and such, the costs of that were paid by private actors and not the government.
Non-discrimination laws, like a lot of litigious policies, are public policy on the cheap. They're unfunded mandates. Politicians at the federal level get to take credit for making an innovation, but they don't pay for it. They foist the cost onto other actors. And this, again, goes back to the big theme of big government versus litigious policies. If you're not willing to raise the revenues to make life better for people with disabilities or to create opportunities that truly equalize society, then litigious policies are an attractive alternative. You give individuals rights to sue against private actors and against states and localities.
And again, you draw a contrast with how this is done in Sweden. The American way is very different. How do they compare?
Well, for instance, one problem with the welfare to work idea in the U.S. for people with disabilities is that to become someone who collects Social Security, you really have to go to a lot of lengths. You have to prove that you are incapable of substantial gainful activity for 6 months. That's very hard, and it's not surprising that once people get on that program, they don't tend to get off. We don't have a lot of great systems for really working with people with disabilities to make sure that they have all the supports necessary to help them get into the job market. Now, take most of Europe, and certainly Sweden would be an example. They have much more elaborate programs to get people onto jobs. They have job subsidies. They have half credit. credits for disability, so you can be half disabled, and so you collect some welfare benefit, but at the same time you have a job. These are things that have been proposed in the U.S., but since most of them involve more fiscal spending, we've been unable to get anywhere with them.
And require bureaucracies to administer.
And they require augmenting the size of government. And again, that's not something that is a very popular tune to sing right about now.
All right, well, let's evaluate this. I mean, this litigation rather than bureaucracy approach, is it efficient? Does it lead to lower costs for society as a whole? Does it lead to better remedies? Or is it kind of expensive, inefficient, and scattered in its solutions?
Well, there's both a good side and a bad side, of course. The good side is that this independence from established power structures can, on occasion, mean that great justices are achieved through litigation that might not have come about any other way. And, you know, things like the problems with the tires on the SUV, I cannot quite remember the name of that, or problems with the Catholic Church. You could go through a long list of things where litigation has been a way to find some deep problem in society that, for whatever reason, the other regulatory agents, the other parts of our society, have been unwilling to diagnose. On the other hand, the system of litigation, regulation by litigation, is extraordinarily inefficient. It costs a lot of money to run. Personal injury liability costs 50% of the time, 50% of the money, roughly, will go to lawyers and administrators, and only about half gets to the victim in the personal injury system. It's highly decentralized, which means that a different jury in a different place, even in the same city, can have a different verdict, and that makes it more of a lottery when you get involved with litigation. There's a third problem, which Americans, for some reason, don't seem to see, which is that not everyone can get to court. It's not so easy to have the wherewithal to find a lawyer, find a claim, and then file your lawsuit. And as you might imagine, people who have more resources are much better able to mobilize claims than poorer people. So when you're trying to use lawsuits to equalize society, you run into this big problem. The people most able to use litigation are the ones with the most advantages.
But you say that also in the health field that very often the people who file medical malpractice suits and such are ones who are undercovered or uninsured.
Yeah, you know, you could think about the whole personal injury system in the U.S. as a partial, pretty thin and pretty ineffective substitute for health care for all people. If you had health care for all people in the U.S., then you could say to the left, I suppose, look, we're not going to allow people to sue for those health care costs because they're already covered. But when you have millions and millions of people uncovered, that's just not possible. And so the tort system and the litigation in general starts to bears a lot of the burden that in other countries is borne by their health and welfare systems.
And since you are working in health-related issues now, the Republicans make a great deal out of malpractice litigation expense that's driving up costs of health care. Is that really a fair picture?
Even the most partisan defender of medical malpractice reform will tell you that the direct costs of medical malpractice, while they can be very tough on individual doctors, and there are these stories about individual doctors having their insurance premiums go way up, at a system level, this is a trivial amount of money. The only real argument is about the indirect effects of medical malpractice. And that's a hard thing to study, and we have a lot of different conclusions, and I'm not sure what to make of them. This is the idea of defensive medicine, that people order more tests because they're afraid that they might get sued if they don't do this. And you can see how hard that is to study, because there's a lot of reasons why you might order a lot of tests. And some of them are very good reasons. Some defensive medicine is a good thing. So sorting that out is very difficult. The anecdotes you get are about individual doctors. What's interesting is that some of the, for instance, the bill that is in Congress that was passed by the House doesn't just apply to individual doctors. It applies to nursing homes, which really doesn't have much to do with the medical malpractice crisis, so-called crisis, and it applies to other people involved in the medical field, not just healthcare providers. So I think the bill is much more sweeping than the problem it's supposedly designed to resolve. There's also an argument about why insurance premiums are creeping up. We don't have great data, publicly available data, I should say, on the costs of tort liability in medical malpractice. And so it's not clear exactly why the costs are going up. It might be more about the pricing strategies of the people who sell medical malpractice insurance rather than the payouts. We just don't know.
Finally, it's kind of hard to say now, after listening to all this, just how serious a problem this is. Is this is a litigation explosion that probably doesn't exist? I mean, is this something that the listeners should worry about, or is it something that is just one problem among many that's kind of far down on the list?
I think it's, I think they should, first of all, be worried about victims. You know, the people who get heard in this debate are the defendants who feel that they've been wronged. And some of them, I think, have been wronged, and that is a problem. But what you don't hear about is all the people out there who are injured, all the injuries that are suffered, all the problems we have, where there's a valid legal claim, but that claim is not brought because a person could not get a lawyer, just didn't have the psychological or whatever wherewithal to mobilize their claims. And so I think the problem is injuries and legal faults. And we used to have a whole debate about that and to talk about legal needs, the fact that a lot of claims weren't being mobilized, you couldn't get a good lawyer. That, you know, Jimmy Carter talked about that in the mid-70s. All of a sudden, that's just kind of fallen out, and now all we talk about is the problems of defendants. I'm not saying that the problems of defendants can't be worked on. I'm just saying that it's a pretty unbalanced debate.
Well, then what better modes of redress are there?
Well, I think in some areas we have to look at no-fault systems. I guess in New York you have no-fault automobile insurance, and I'm sure there's debate about that. But in general, no-fault systems seem to work pretty well. Vaccine Injury Compensation Act, which was briefly in the news recently, is a good example. That was a case where childhood vaccines were being decimated by liability litigation. They were down to one maker for each vaccine. This is in the mid-80s, and they were worried because of liability about losing all the companies. There were a lot of lawsuits. On the other hand, families who were suing faced a very uncertain outcome. Very few of them were actually winning, just enough to scare the hell out of the vaccine makers, but not enough to give decent compensation to victims. So what Congress designed was a system where every time you get a vaccine, a child gets a vaccine, they pay a small surtax that goes into a government program, and whoever can show that they had an injury caused by a vaccine gets compensation in a system that's much more low cost, much easier to get into, and has much more reliable compensation. And we should look at expanding no-fault to other areas where it could have it could be much more just and equitable than tort litigation. And I think there's potential in areas like automobile. There may be a potential to expand it in the area of medical malpractice, and there's a lot of people interested in that. More generally, if we could expand national health care, if we could expand some of the disability programs, then we wouldn't put so much burden on liability systems, and we wouldn't be having as an intense a tort debate.
Okay, well, thank you for joining us, Tom Burkey.
All right, thank you.
And that was Thomas Burkey, B-U-R-K-E, who is an assistant professor at Wellesley College and a research fellow with the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation Scholars in Health Policy Program at the University of California at Berkeley. That's it for me, Doug Henwood. Stay tuned for the news. And next week, I will be here on recording playing the interview I did several months ago with Nobel Prize winner Joseph Stiglitz. It's not every day you get to interview a Nobel Prize winner, so I thought I would relive some past glories while I was off celebrating the Christmas holidays in Massachusetts. Let's let P.J. Harvey have the last word, and till 2 weeks from now, when I'll be back in front of these microphones. Good night.